Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to another exciting FIA webinar. This month, for November, we're doing a changing industry, keeping pace with the trends. This is Adam Russo, your host, who's been your host for the past couple of years. With me, as always, is our Senior VP and General Counsel, Ron Peck. Say hello, Ron.
Hello, Ron.
In addition, we have John Jablon, one of our legal counsels here, as well as the fan favorite, the 12th man, the first guy off the bench, or the last guy off the bench, the guy that, you know, when I was in high school, they had the Hustle Award. That's the guy that actually didn't get the play. They just gave him the award for most hustle. This our favorite and attorney here at FIA, Chris Aguirre, is with us as well. So today, we're going to be talking about a topic, the fiduciary responsibility, I think is really, really important. This is the latest we've ever done a webinar. It's 3 o'clock Eastern time here in Boston. It started to get a little cold out, too. Just for you guys that aren't from the Boston area, we had pretty nice weather this weekend. We actually had 60 degrees on Friday. So I think it's getting now back to what it's supposed to be, which is the 30s. But we're excited about our presentation today. There's a lot to go over. We have 1 hour to do so. As always, please feel free to email on the bottom of that little chat box there. Feel free to type in any questions. We will do our best to make sure we have time to go over those questions with you. But as always, we have a great audience and a lot to cover. So with that, let's get right into the overview. These are some of the things we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about the cost, the overall cost of healthcare. I don't know if you've noticed, and basically I think a lot of you have, we're seeing a lot of response to some of our stuff that we blogged out there and put in on LinkedIn as well as other places. What we have noticed is the cost of healthcare is rising so high that many of these large carriers are pulling out of the exchanges. And why is that happening? Because, as we've talked about many times, the proponents of Obamacare, the proponents of Romneycare here in our home state of Massachusetts, they put all their focus and emphasis in regard to giving people access to health insurance, but not really focusing on how much it actually costs. So just today, I was reading, before I walked in here, Boston Business Journal, which talks a lot about healthcare, what's happening in our state. Two big stories right on the front page. This is the Boston Business Journal, not the healthcare journal, talking about the Cadillac tax is coming. Help. One. Second, talking about how many of our, basically all the insurers using our connector plan, the Medicare, Medicaid plans, how they're bleeding tremendously because they just can't keep up with the rising costs based on what they promised the state and what the state is requiring them to charge for premiums. There has to be some give there. So we're seeing a lot of cost issues. Second, we're going to talk a little bit about the growth of self-funding, the new self-funded industry. This is not the self-funded industry in 2013 or even 2014. It's really changed dramatically. We like to be a think tank here at FIA, and even we've noticed a lot of changes happening in the industry that we just weren't expecting. Next, the fiduciary finger pointing. A lot of that. It's like my two-year-olds, when one likes to point their finger at the other when I ask them, you know, who spilled the milk or who did something bad, the other blame it on the other one. We're seeing a lot of that happen in today's industry as well. Also, what today's appeals look like. The appeals of today are very different than the typical appeal that you would see for some grammatical error or some clerical error. You're seeing a really, really innovative, there's a lot of really tough questions. We're getting tougher questions, and we're the ones who deal with this on a daily basis, and sometimes we get stuff like, wow, we've never seen that before. Next, we're going to talk about PACE, keeping pace with the trend. This is our new fiduciary product that we've successfully sold and marketed for the past few months, and we look forward to expanding its offerings in 2016. Last but not least, we're going to talk about some of the more interesting, innovative, and productive ways to contain costs, stay competitive within the self-funded marketplace based on all the stuff that we're seeing right now, and also to help create a profit center for all the administrators and brokers out there in the industry. All right, so let's talk about this really quickly. The biggest reason why we have a problem in our healthcare system goes right back to this slide. Everything we're talking about today, I want you to remember this slide and think about every one of these examples was affected by this actual slide. First, what do members care about? All they care about are their co-pays and deductibles. That's it. Folks, they do not care about the entire bill. Whereas you're a vendor or you're an administrator or you're a plan, you might have you might complain about the fact that why don't members care about the bills? Well, why would they? They're paying their copay, they're paying their out-of-pocket, their deductible, and until it's the new year and when they see their new premium increases, That's when they start to complain. What do plants care about? Again, not the whole bill. What the plants care about are the dollar exposures up to their spec. So we represent over 100,000 plants. We have plants tell us all the time, you know, those members, you know, they don't care about the whole bill. And I'm thinking to myself, neither do you. That bill is $750,000, and all you're thinking about is, man, thank God I purchased stop-loss coverage at $25,000. This is a stop-loss carrier's problem. So, bringing up the point, what do the stop-loss carriers care about? What the stop-loss carriers care about is the whole bill. The problem is, stop-loss carriers are not health insurers. They do everything possible, rightfully so, to show that they are not a carrier. They are not a health insurance. They are not a health insurer. They are not health insurance. Why? They don't need to be regulated by health care reform. We already have the other side, and I call the other side the state regulators, et cetera, trying to push and show that stop-loss carriers are somehow subject to health care reform and the ACA rules. So the one entity in our industry, this whole little big pile of entities that we have going on, the self-insured industry, the one entity that actually focuses on the entire bill and what we could do to limit the exposure on that bill isn't even a health insurer, which I think is pretty interesting. So what's next? And what about the fiduciary aspect? What are we focusing on that? What about brokers? What do they care about? They care about keeping the plan happy at any cost. And that's one of the problems that we see with brokers in many times is, and there are many good, great brokers out there. I would even call them brokers. I like to call the good ones advisors because they're not just a middleman in between two entities. They're actually giving advice to their clients. And I think that's how our industry has changed. You see a lot less of brokering deals and a lot more advising and expertise. And because you see brokers doing a lot more advising and expertise, their goal is to keep that plan happy. But the problem is, are they keeping that plan happy in the short term, or are they keeping that plan happy in the long term? If you're a broker and you care about keeping your client happy in the short term, you take them to a Patriots game. By the way, Ron, I apologize for that loss last night. I want to make sure my Browns are having an exciting game tonight, huh?
Big time.
What a great Monday night football game.
Prime time.
7-2-8. Prime time. Unbelievable. Anyway, the point being on this is they care about the short term. So when that $400,000 bill comes in, a lot of times that broker's like, listen, just make sure stop loss reimburses. Because in the short term, I want my plan to be happy and not have exposure. But in the long term, that broker should be really educating that plan and getting them to focus on reducing the overall bill. Because upon a renewal, guess what? That plan is going to have a very scary premium increase. And now that broker might not have a client anymore. So when you try to keep the plan happy, you not only have to think about the entire bill, you got to think about your fiduciary duty. And why is that? For the exact same reason I just brought up. Brokers are not brokers. TPAs are not administrators. We are not just lawyers. People look at us as fiduciaries. People look at us as experts. People look at us as, please tell me how I'm supposed to get through this day. How am I supposed to deal with all these regulatory changes? What is the Cadillac tax? How do I deal with it? How do I deal with the calculator? What do I do about stop loss? What do I do about this network contract? There is so much more expertise and reliance on administrators and brokers and attorneys than there ever was before. This isn't 2010 or 2005 where you just signed up for health insurance and got your premium increased and then renewed. There are so many changes from plan design, stop-loss regulations, and so forth, that the fiduciary duty has become a big part of the cost driver. So, speaking about what providers actually care about, and one thing the providers really care about is not having to justify their charges. So, at the end of the day, all of our entities in our industry, care about something completely different. We are not unified on caring about the entire bill and how to lower the overall cost of the claim. The facilities know that. The lawyers representing the facilities know that there are all these different moving parts, which is what makes self-funding great and unique and innovative, but it also what potentially can fragment us as an industry. So the fact that the providers don't have to justify what they're charging and the fact that each one of us has a different, what's the word I'm looking for, agenda, it's really causing the overall cost of care to continue to go up. And the reality is providers are going to keep on taking advantage of this as long as all of us players in the industry realize that what matters is the overall cost of medical care being the problem. problem and tackling that issue head on by being understanding that we are going to take some fiduciary risk and some responsibility in making this whole system change. And how do we make it change? Through true transparency. Now, when I say true transparency, I can tell you that really it's altruistic in my mind, because even though all we hear about is transparency, every network contract that I have seen doesn't allow a free market approach where all facilities and hospitals, et cetera, are allowed to show what their charges are on a website. We're seeing this. So, next slide. The growth. What have we seen? Here's the reality. This is the most recent information that we have. We see that employers under 100 lives, less than 5% self-fund. Up to 500 lives is about 26%. And over 500 lives is still 82%. So there's a lot of opportunity for growth in that piece. Here's what the interesting piece is. In the fourth quarter of 2013-14, self-funding increased by 4 million lives. These are all plans that either have never been self-funded, or either were on the exchanges, or were fully insured, or didn't offer health insurance at all. That means these are 4 million lives who have never needed to be a fiduciary. They have never known what that word even means. They have never needed to see that risk. That's 4 million lives that could potentially go to the ASO market rather than the TPA market as a result. In the same exact time period, 5 million fully insured lives left. Some of them went self-funded, many of them went to the exchange. But here's what we realize. We're noticing a shift. Fully insured lives are going down. Self-funded lives are going up. With that self-funding status comes the fiduciary status that for the first time ever these people need to understand.
Sure. Hey, Adam. So let's just cover something real quick as far as those lives are concerned. You know, when we're talking about the 4 million lives that have gone self-funded and the 5 million that have left fully insured, you know, maybe that leaves a million that are scattered into the exchanges or whatever. You have to understand, the carriers who were banking on the success of the exchanges, they thought that they were going to receive at least the 4, maybe 5 million lives that were leaving fully insured. Those are more likely than not healthy, low-risk lives. You look at what's happening with the exchanges now, and you have your United and the other large carriers starting to second-guess their decision to participate in the exchanges. This is a result of what we've called adverse selection, where the low-risk lives are going self-funded and the high-risk lives, the ones that are sort of left at the bottom of the bucket, are the only ones that are ending up in the exchange. And a risk pool which is populated by only high-risk lives cannot be financially sustained, especially at the prices that they're being forced to charge in premium. That's scary. Now, think about it. These carriers were willing to support the ACA and the creation of exchanges just because they thought they were going to get these lives. And now those lives are available to you. And we are allowing them to slip between our fingers and go to the ASOs. Now, I don't have a problem with the ASOs. That's still self-funding, and in general, I'm a supporter of self-funding. But at the same time, there are certain things that a TPA can do for a self-funded plan that ASOs can't do as far as customization is concerned. And those are things that we're going to touch upon during this presentation. But again, those lives are out there. They're there for you. You just need to know how to attract them. And the same old way of doing business is not going to work. These are new school lives. They're afraid of risk. They think self-funding is just a new way to save money. We need to care for these lives with kid gloves compared to what we've been doing with our current lives. They're almost considered contemporaries of the TPA.
Right. Thanks, Ron. That's a great segue here. We mentioned all the lives leaving the fully insured world and coming into the self-funded world. ASOs, if you've ever listened to the FIA Group talk, you probably know that we very much prefer TPA self-funding to ASO self-funding. And there are a lot of reasons behind that, but that being said, ASOs definitely offer some features that TPAs don't and can't. And one of the main features is that ASO self-funding really mimics the fully insured world. There are a lot of bundles that self-funded health plans can really take advantage of with ASOs. One main thing that we experience all the time, self-funded health plans don't need to worry about gaps in coverage with their stop-loss policy. And why is that? Of course, it's because the ASO offers a stock stop-loss policy and a stock plan document. And there are no room for gaps because there's no room for customization. Now, the pros and cons of that, you can make your own chart, and where we land might not be where you land, or it might be where you land. But at the end of the day, employers that are new to self-funding, they're scared. they might not be ready for the full gamut of customization and risk that comes with self-funding with a TPA. Now, ASOs, like I said, they are doing some things right. They have comprehensive networks, including wrap, lease, and rental networks. Like I mentioned, there are no stop-loss gaps because the policy is theirs and the plan document is theirs, and they're crafted specifically to conform with one another. And the assumption of fiduciary duties is on the ASO's shoulder. The plan administrator is the ASO. In general, the self-funded health plan itself, the plan sponsor, the employer, has very, very little fiduciary duty, especially when it comes to making decisions on claims and appeals. And the reason for that is that the ASO charges more money for it because it realizes that the plan administrators, they're just not ready to do it themselves.
So the bottom line fact is, in regards to, if I'm a fully insured plan, I'm one of these 5 million lives, okay? And I got my 500 life group. I've been fully insured. I finally realized, you know what? Maybe self-funding is for me. And I am with, let's just say, Blue Cross Blue Shield, fully insured. It's going to be really easy for me to decide to go to an ASO with Blue Cross Blue Shield because nothing changes. My employees don't notice a difference. They have the same network. They have the same ID card, basically. They have the same doctor. Their kids can go to the same pediatrician. Everything stays the same. The only difference is now I, as the employer, are paying medical claims out of my own pocket. But I don't have to worry about the fiduciary risk. I don't have to worry about the plan design. I don't even care about the charges because they're telling me they'll cover everything. Except because I'm just spending my money, I have no control how that money is spent. That, to me, is what makes it scarier. If anything, the sell on an ASO versus the TPA is that it's easier, it's safer, no gaps. Don't worry, we've got you covered. When in reality, I think it's scarier because there's a $1 million claim. Don't worry, you got a 50% discount. You're only paying $500,000. And don't worry, you got stop loss of $50,000. So you're only paying $50,000, stop loss is paying $450,000. But guess what? Next year when I renew, right now, November, I'm renewing. What's my premium increase going to be? And at that point in time, I'm not going to feel so good. And that is the sale, is that the assumption of the fiduciary duty, which is what ASOs are doing right, taking on that risk, they're saying, don't worry about it, we got you. The reality is these are 5 million lives that have come over in 1 year to self-funding for the first time. They never experienced it before. They don't want to be the bearer of that risk. They don't want to make the claim decision. Sally in HR doesn't want to decide whether her coworker's kid gets covered for a cancer treatment that's off-label use of a drug. That's the reality, and it's a huge selling point that the ASO market uses against the TPA world.
Right, and just a quick final point here regarding stop-loss gaps. Many of you participating in this webinar have already taken advantage of the service we offer called a gap-free analysis, where we compare a plan document to the stop-loss policy that insures it. And it's actually kind of funny. When we receive an SPD for an ASO and a stop-loss policy for that same ASO, I just send an email back saying, well, there's no reason to even do this. There are no gaps. There are absolutely none. And the brokers, you know, respond, and the stop-loss carriers respond and say, well, that's fantastic. And I say, yes, to a point, but you're paying for it. This group is really paying for this consistency. It's
right.
Great, but it costs money.
Right.
Okay, so this is Ron. Let me tell you something. It sounds to me like there's a lot of benefits to working with an ASO, and the fact of the matter is there is. And it's out there. It's successful for a reason, and justifiably so. But at the same time, if amongst those 4 to 5 million lives that are coming to self-funding, there exists a plan or plans that really, you know, they could go ASO or TPA, they're indifferent. Or they would go TPA if they had all the facts. Or if a TPA was willing to take on some additional risk. Those are the lives that you need to work to capture. I understand there are going to be some lives that are going to go with an ASO because they have so much risk aversion. They really just want a fully insured product, but they want to save money, so they're willing to self-fund it. As far as who's funding the claims, everything else is the same as their fully insured product. Eventually, there are some plans you simply cannot match. Guess what? Don't go after that business. But the rest, you need flexibility. I don't know about you, but a lot of the major cities, particularly in the Northeast, but I think all over the country now,
they do these things called Restaurant Week, where a number of restaurants in the area, what they'll do is they'll actually prepare a price-fixed menu. You go in, they pick your appetizer, the entree, dessert, and it's a flat fee, and that's it.
The only time of the year I get a good meal, Ron.
There you go, Chris. I don't know about that, man. I mean,
Adam takes good care of us, you know, when you're working late, get a pizza, maybe a cheeseburger.
But anyway, so this price-fixed menu, a lot of people, they go into these restaurants they've never been in before. Maybe the menu is in another language. And you know what you do? You say, you know what? No noise, no muss, no fuss. I'm just going to go with the price fixed menu, and I'm going to get what they're giving me, and I'm going to pay the fee that they tell me I should pay. And for a lot of people, that works. Now, me, I'm not into dessert. And if I remove the dessert from that price fixed menu, all of a sudden, I'm paying more for the appetizer and entree than I would if I picked a la carte off the menu. So what do? I say, forget the dessert. I'm going to spend as much or less than the price fix, and I'm going to pick each item off the menu, and I'm going to customize the meal to match my desire. The problem? If I don't know what I'm doing, I might end up selecting some creamy New England clam chowder and some shrimp fettuccine Alfredo. That's way too much cream sauce. I'm going to end up with a stomachache by the end of the night, which is why someone like me, inexperienced in selecting things a la carte, need someone like you to come in and say, hey, listen, customization is great, but I'm going to hold your hand. This is the first time you've done this. Let me guide you. We need to find that middle ground. We need to enable plants to customize their plan, bringing forth the benefit of working with a TPA, the true benefit of being self-funded, customizing your plan, having full access to the claims data, choosing the best carrier, choosing your vendors, and at the same time, providing that kind of guidance that will help them avoid making mistakes and ultimately avoiding them never choosing to go self-funded the next year or the year after. And right now, and you can see all these different things that you can customize, subrogation, negotiation, medical tourism, all these are things that you can provide to a plan, but you need to educate them on how to do it. But ultimately, the thing that most employers are most concerned about when it comes to self-funding is, what decisions am I going to have to make, and am I going to be responsible for those decisions? That risk aversion, that fear of that fiduciary duty is ultimately, as far as we've seen, one of, if not the biggest concern a lot of these plans are having. So is it worth it? Well, yeah, it's worth it if you're a plan sponsor. It's been shown that these customized plans, particularly when you have professional guidance between wellness and tourism and plan design, custom networks and carve-outs, you save money easily within 5 years, if not before then. But getting them through those initial years, getting them past that risk aversion, that's the key. And there's other things to take into consideration as well. There's the risk aversion of you, the TPA, the broker, the stop-loss carrier. If you're going to guide the, you know, you should really consider a narrow network. Hey, you should really consider medical tourism, direct contracting. Hey, I've got a center of excellence. I want to send people to the Cleveland Clinic, to the Mayo Clinic. Well, that's great. But what happens if somebody ends up suffering an injury because of some sort of never event or malpractice? Are you responsible? Weren't you the one who told the plan and the plan member that they should go to the Cleveland Clinic where they ended up suffering an injury? Are they going to come after you? So it's not just dealing with the risk aversion of your clients. It's dealing with your risk aversion as well. So we want to make sure everybody keeps that in mind as we go through these options that are available to you as a TPA, broker, or stop-loss carrier to try and emulate that all-encompassing risk-taking, risk-shifting practice of the ASOs and fully insured market. So when we're talking about these lives, these new prospects, we call them sort of the new school self-funder. TPAs, in general, are the best of the best when it comes to old-school self-funding. When a large employer comes through the door and says, I want to self-fund, that large, old-school self-funded employer, they want to hear about the options available to them. They want to hear about all the control they're going to have. They basically just want you to press the button, process the claims, and if there's ever a question, hey, you send it back to us. I've got a board for that. We're meeting. We're discussing it. We decide what's going to happen.
We got 10 lawyers in-house that can help us with answering these questions.
I've been doing this. My father was self-funded. My grandfather was self-funded. When we started this business, there was no way we were ever going to take our employees' benefits, health care, and put it in the hands of a third party, whether it's an insurance carrier or a TPA. At the end of the day, we take care of our own. Oh, you love that, right? That's a big jumbo employer, big factory in the Midwest. But today, these lives that are shifting to self-funding, they don't want to self-fund because they want to control the benefits, because they want to have a hands-on approach to their employees' health care.
Cheaper.
It's all about the money. Exactly. So get over that mentality that the reason they're coming to you is because they want that control. When you look at an RFP and it asks, are you willing to take on the fiduciary duty? Are you willing to make the final decisions when it comes to appeals? Are you willing to tell them whether they should exclude this or pay for that? How should their plan document be structured? You know, should they use a large network or direct contracting? It's not a trick question. If you're thinking that, oh, you know, if we say yes, they're going to say, ha-ha, we got you. We want to do that. We don't want you to do it.
Right.
Because we want you to take on that.
And there's a reason why 88% of the RFPs that are out there right now are asking TPAs a fiduciary shift question. So, again, as Ron said, they're not trying to do a gotcha. But they're actually thinking, hey, we don't really want to be this fiduciary. We don't want to take on this risk. We heard about self-funding. We're sick of our premiums going up. We want to take a shot at this. We got 300 lives. Let's take a look at it. You need to be able to say yes to this question if you want to pick up these new school self-funded plans.
And this is your last chance. If you think about who these employers are, these are the employers, small, medium-sized employers, who have been paying for fully funded insurance until now. They are the ones who see a 10, 20, 30% increase every year in their premium. They don't bat an eye. They sign the dotted line, and they just pay. So if they go to an ASO and they get mediocre service, they're never going to leave. These are the employers who they make a decision, they lock it in, and they don't change their plan structure until a federal law is passed that basically forces their hand. So this is your opportunity to not only gain new clients, but gain the types of clients who once they're locked in, they either don't have the effort, desire, or sophistication to question their plan structure after that. So this is your one shot. They are leaving their current plan, they're going to a new plan, and if you don't catch them this time, they're gone forever.
Thanks, Ron. We're now going to move on to fiduciary finger pointing. And as Adam mentioned before, there is a lot of that going around, especially in this changing industry where courts and mediators and arbitrators and all sorts of neutral third parties are leaning more and more heavily on the issue of patients' rights.
Think about this, right? Under healthcare reform, IROs, okay, these independent review organizations, where a patient has a right to appeal to an external IRO, the cost isn't on the member. So it isn't like the member has to spend $2,000-$3,000 out of pocket to file an external appeal for a clinical reason. It's borne by the plan. So it doesn't hurt them to file. It's like, hey, maybe this will go in our favor. So that's why you see a lot more of this stuff all across the country, Ron.
A lot of hospitals now, actually, if their patient's claim is denied, they're starting to catch on that this right to an external appeal is available to every plan member. They're actually counseling patients to appeal not once but twice, go through the entire internal process, and demand their right to an external appeal.
Yeah, the patient has absolutely no incentive to not file an external appeal. Of course, they're only available for certain denials, such as medical judgment denials, but that doesn't stop providers and members from requesting them. And a lot of the times, plans and TPAs are just too scared to say no because the ACA is still new and there are penalties assessed all the time. And fiduciary duty breach is a huge, huge hot button issue. So sometimes when an external appeal is requested, plans or TPAs just say, okay, pay the fee. And even when the medical review comes back as this is not eligible for external review, the fee is already paid and it's done with, and the member is no worse off, even though the plan and TPA are worse off. So that's something that providers are getting increasingly aware of.
You're getting savvy on it.
Yes, they are. And they're coming out with form letters like providers do. You know, facilities always send letters saying, we demand an external appeal. You know, and that's even sometimes before claims are paid. I mean, it's just these letters come out and people don't really look at them. They get them off a website and they fill them out. And that's that.
But this information is shared, folks. I mean, there's webinars. We call it listening to the enemy, right? Where, you know, we're listening to their calls like as if we were spies, just, you know, listening to conference calls. At the end of the day, they're sharing this information. They're doing what they can to share it. They're doing what they can to educate themselves and each other on how to help get claims paid. five plans, using an IRO as an option. So it's really important that you know that.
Yeah, and as we know, you know, obviously it has to do with this IRO requirement. Plans are required to contract with at least three URAC-accredited IROs. And the way that works in practice is typically not that the plans themselves will contract with the IROs, because as we've talked about, the plans themselves are just kind of hanging on for dear life. They're just trying to exercise their fiduciary duties in the best way they'll know how and keep it as simple as possible. And as we know, in the self-funded world, it is anything but simple. So what happens in general is that the TPA contracts with these three IROs, and that's one of the ways that the TPA can really help the plan in this new self-funded universe. Now, the next thing I'm going to talk about is really kind of mind-blowing, and it's got real big implications on the industry as a whole. It's the case of Rose versus Health Comp, Inc., and this case is about disclosures of PHI. In this case, the plan administrator, or really I should just say the employer, the plan sponsor, asked the TPA for PHI that belongs to the plan. The TPA disclosed it to an individual of the employer who is, in fact, permitted to receive that PHI under the plan document. Well, the plan administrator slash plan sponsor slash employer used that PHI for a non-plan purpose. What that PHI was used for was to essentially discriminate against a participant based on that PHI. What happened then is that the patient sued the TPA for acting not in the plan's best interest, but instead acting just in the employer's best interest. Now, the problem there is that when the TPA got the request for the PHI, the TPA didn't know who was requesting it, whether it was the plan administrator or the plan sponsor, also known as the employer, because, of course, with most self-funded entities, it's the same company. For example, with the FIA Group self-funded plan, the FIA Group LLC is both the employer, plan sponsor, and the FIA Group LLC is also the plan administrator. If we ask our TPA for PHI, it kind of has no reason to say no because we are the plan administrator.
Right, we are both.
If we turn around and use it for a non-plan purpose, what the plaintiff in this case said is that the TPA somehow should have known, but as we all know, as a TPA, if you receive a legitimate request for PHI, you're going to honor it because it's your client and you seem to have no reason not to. So the main reason I bring this up is because it really has large impact on the industry, and TPAs are under increased scrutiny. The scrutiny is really increasing all the time. And I also just want to mention that in our last quarterly newsletter, we presented a summary of this case that may not have painted the facts in the most accurate light possible. So we just wanted to make sure we clarified here and get this on the record as really a problem that's facing all the TPAs in the industry.
In addition, I want to make sure you guys realize that this is a fiduciary issue potentially for all of you. Think about it. You're doing what you're supposed to do. You give the information, the protected health information, to the employer as you're required to do under your ASA. If you look at a typical ASA, the plan with a TPA has the right to its claims data. That is one of the benefits.
I was going to say,
one of the biggest selling points of working with a TPA is this is your data. You pay the claims, you own it. You can use this information to run whatever reports you want, it's yours. The fact that an employer may use that information in a non-health plan related process or reason to put that back on the administrator for why they give the information in the first place is really scary. If you think about it, because it says if I'm asking our TPA, we work with a TPA, obviously, and they give us the health information, I look at that information, I go, hey, Ron, we got to fire these four employees because they're costing us too much money on our health plan. Find a reason to get rid of them. To go back and blame my administrator, who has a duty to send me that information in the first place, it's really slippery slope that I'm afraid of, that we're noticing more and more of this kind of stuff happening across the industry.
I wonder if, do you think, and again, maybe this is just sort of thinking out loud, but could you imagine if the court were to, let's say, demand maybe something in writing from the TPA, some sort of an agreement with them and the plan, limiting what the plan can use the PHI for, but ultimately at the end of the day, isn't that already in the ASA as far as what the PHI is to be used for, the BAA between them?
I just don't see what more they could do. Maybe you should be hired as a defense attorney there, Ron. That's a good argument. It's probably brought up, though. Chris?
Thanks, Adam. So, look, you know, throughout the whole thing, we've sort of been talking about this whole concept of fiduciary, and Adam said something very early on that I think it's important to point out again. people look at us as fiduciaries. So you can write it in your ASA, and you can disclaim it on your documents.
Or you email like we do.
Or you email. At the end of the day, there's a very specific test under ERISA. It's a four-prong test. If you fit one of those four prongs, you could be a fiduciary. And newsflash, those new school self-funded benefit plans, when things don't go their way, are going to point a finger at you. In fact, I often think to myself, if I worked for an ASO and I wanted to go get some of those new 4 million lives that are coming over from the fully insured world, what would I do? I'd bring these cases with me. Express Oil and Johnson Towers. I mean, if you guys haven't heard about them yet, you should. They are perfect scare stories, if you will. You know, broker advises the plan on something. It doesn't go right. And what does the plan do? It turns around and points at the broker. In Express Oil, it was a $2.8 million claim. The broker, there was only stop loss for $75,000 of it, and the employer was like, whoa, we didn't know that. So if I'm an ASO, what am I doing? I'm taking this case, and I said, this never would have happened to us.
Just so you know, folks, this case, okay, and again, I apologize if this sounds like a sale, but this gap review, if we got hired by A&B Insurance Services to perform a gap review for Express Oil Change to see if there's any gaps in coverage with the stop loss policy, we would have told them that if X, Y, Z had happened, you don't have stop loss coverage. That would have cost them under $1,000. And this claim cost how much, Chris?
$2.8 million.
So when I think spend a little bit,
$75,000 spec.
Right. To spend a little bit in order to save a lot. I mean, I think that tells you a lot. But that's that case is a great example of gaps in policy, brokers not really being sure of what they were being sold. No issue with the stop-loss carrier. The stop-loss carrier specifically says what it's going to cover, what it's not going to cover. But it just didn't match up with the plan doc. And you had a situation where someone was going to get in trouble, and it was easy to point the finger at the broker. And now that fiduciary duty is now there's more and more case law showing finger pointing at the broker. That broker is going to finger point at the administrator.
You know, in law school, they teach us, you know, how to build sort of concepts, and we always talk about seminal cases, the cases that, you know, kicked off the change in the law. And in 5 or 10 years, when we look back at this whole fiduciary transfer concept, these are the cases that we're going to look at. We're going to look at these cases and say, those are the ones that made us sit back and think, whoa, how do we fix this problem? Because an ASO is showing this story to your potential clients and telling them this is why you shouldn't go with a traditional
team. I would ask you, Google, if you ever want to look at how ASOs market to their brokers, these cases and what they represent are typical examples of what they talk about. Not having to worry about these potential gaps, not having to worry about having exposure to these types of claims. So the ERISA penalties are serious. The treble damages involved are serious. So it really doesn't matter what you say. It's really more of a matter of what you actually do. And, Chris, I know you want to share a couple of examples, but folks, just so you know, these are actual claim examples that we see. These are our, like, top 8, right? We could have just did a top 10, but I guess we didn't want to come up with two more. But we have a top 8, and this is typical of what we see on a daily basis for the millions of lives we represent and the type of finger-pointing words that we're noticing.
Yeah, I mean, look, number one comes across my desk, like, at least 5 times a week. And look, these are the kind of examples we're talking about, folks. When we talk about who made the decision, who took authority, on every single claim decision, when there's a question of interpretation, are you as the administrator going back to that client to ask for their take?
Right.
I'm guessing the answer to that question is no.
Right.
So when the language says something about, you know, DUI felonious versus not felonious, or the work comp exclusion, do you or do you not have to have work comp for it to apply? If the language isn't clear, how are you applying that language? Are you asking? Is the answer to that question no? I bet it is. And if it is, guess what? You just open the door to fiduciary liability. Decisions you make every single day raise the question of, are you a fiduciary? And trust me, for any of you that have been involved in one of these sort of situations, you know, the second the proverbial you know what hits the fan, that employer, especially that new age employer who's starting to self-fund now, they're saying, whoa, 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 this isn't what I signed up for. I thought I was getting, you know, ABCinsuranceinc.com.
If you were to sit down the plan sponsor, the employer, in each of the scenarios that Chris and John are about to go through, and in your mind, imagine a hypothetical situation where these are the facts, and an attorney or a judge were to ask the employer, why did you decide that this is what the plan document means? Why did you decide that this is how the claim should be paid? If that employer's response would be, I didn't make that decision. My TPA did. You're the fiduciary.
Or conversely, if you're the TPA on the stand, you've seen this before, Adam, right? And they, on cross-examination, ask, who makes these decisions? And the TPA, the claims manager, says, I do. Guess what? Have a fun trying to prove to the court after that, or the jury, or whoever's making the decision, that you weren't the fiduciary.
Right. And in addition to these examples being an example of fiduciary finger-pointing and issues where there's potentially fiduciary liability for the plan and or TPA, keep in mind that each of these examples represents a pretty significant potential stop-loss gap.
Absolutely.
For example, if your SPD excludes felonious acts, and you say, oh, DWI, it's a misdemeanor, I'm not going to exclude that. Well, guess what? Your stop-loss policy probably will exclude
it. But, John, you explained something really well. The reason why you have a fiduciary finger-pointing in the first place is because someone didn't pay the claim. So the point being is, you don't have a fiduciary issue. You don't have a lawsuit. Remember the first slide. Let's go back to that first slide. What does the plan care about? How much they spent up to the spec? If the plan notices that their claim isn't being reimbursed, meaning they're paying for the whole bill,
that's when they start asking questions,
pointing fingers, and start suing people. So every one of these is an example where somebody isn't paying something and it's going back to the plan to having to pay more. The plan is paying more and having to care about more than what they think they should care about. That's the point. So every one of these examples, look at it. The second one, not offered COBRA in a timely manner, therefore could not be properly at COBRA. That means the plan is paying more money. Next, SPD's definition of E&I being silent or off-label drug use. Stop-loss carrier is what? Saying what on this case? Not sure if we're going to pay the claim. Same thing with the clinical audit and code edit.
This one's my favorite.
Yeah, Chris.
It's literally the TPA, and by the way, in the TPA's defense, trying to do good, trying to bring about cost containment opportunities and more savings for their plan, but they're literally going outside of the four corners of the plan doc and using determinations by other decision makers, vendors, who are saying, well, you should pay X, with no consideration for what the plan actually says. And we see these virtually every single day.
Got it. So let's look at a couple more examples. John, I know you want to bring these up.
Yeah, one that we constantly see is the issue of FMLA leave and FMLA running concurrently with employer leaves of absence. And because employers can really do whatever they want, you know, in their own employment practices, and that they are the ones structuring the plan documents, it very often gets complicated between the employee handbook and the SPD and unwritten leave policies and favorable policies given to high-ranking employees.
Policies that were grandfathered in for old employees that aren't grandfathered in for new ones.
Absolutely.
This is a great example where, you know, if you're a stop-loss carrier, and you agree to mirror the terms of the plan document. Well, the plan document doesn't mention any of this stuff because it's all in the employee handbook.
Right.
Then what?
Yeah.
The employer is stuck paying the claim because it's in their employee handbook. The SPD doesn't make any reference to it. Now that employer is stuck with the entire bill. Back to that fiduciary finger point. Who is to blame there? Is it the broker's fault? They were brought in to bring in a stop-loss carrier. Is it the stop-loss carrier's fault? They don't even know there's a handbook. Is it the TPA's fault? They're administrating the health plan claims. Yeah, one of them is going to be blamed. And that's why you need to shift that risk.
Right, thanks. And one of the things that we do sometimes see is because the issue of FMLA and leave gets so murky, and because stop-loss policies frequently have provisions regarding actively at work and things of that nature, what we see a lot are TPAs and plans talking to the stop-loss carrier and saying, hey, how would you do this? And stop-loss renders its, you know, advice, because, of course, stop-loss is not making a claim determination. And maybe the plan does what stop-loss says. And you know, guess what? The plan might not be right. The plan may have breached its fiduciary duty because the stop-loss carrier is looking at the policy while the plan's looking at the plan.
And this is why I really think it's important that we actually talk about our service in regards to how we can actually help employers. And, Ron, I want you to, if you don't mind, take a little bit of time because you spent a lot of time building this product over the past
year. Yeah, thanks, guys. So here's where I feel we are at this point, right? We've got the TPA who's trying to please everybody, the broker who's trying to please everybody. But unfortunately, it reminds me of one of those sitcoms where
the main character is dating, you know, four different girls at the same time, and he doesn't want any of them to know about the other. And if I'm the plan, right, I'm looking, I've got my plan document, which says one thing. I've got stop loss, which assumes the plan document is the only thing I'm abiding by. You know, so stop loss lives in a perfect world where I only have a plan document. But in reality, I've also got an employee contract, the handbook with my employees. I've got a network contract that tells providers that I'm going to do something else. Maybe I have another contract, you know, with another carrier. Maybe I have a secondary plan. Oh, and don't forget that I also have to coordinate with Medicare. The problem is you're juggling so many balls, and they all differ, that you can't possibly serve all of these masters without displeasing the others. So number one, ensuring that all of the documents align, that there are no gaps, that the stop loss ensures the plan, and that they cover the same claims and exclude the same issues. Two, that the employee handbook aligns with the plan benefits, that one doesn't offer something that the other denies. Three, if you do have a network agreement, ensuring that that network arrangement is captured and limited by the terms of the plan. Making sure that all of these things align, that's responsibility number one. Once you have a plan that's perfectly aligned, you should be able to receive claims and either pay or deny them in accordance with the plan and avoid most noise. However, anytime you deny a claim, whether for right or wrong, somebody's going to be unhappy, right? The provider, the patient. They're going to appeal, as is their right. That appeal comes in. You decide again. Did we make the right decision or did we make a mistake? If you made the right decision, you deny again. If you made a mistake, correct your error. After you deny a second time, there is that final internal appeal. This is game time. When that final appeal arrives, this is your last opportunity to ensure that you paid the claim properly
or denied it properly.
Because ultimately, if you continue to deny after this final appeal, it's going to an external appeal level. An IRO, a court of law, someone other than you is going to examine your work. This is your last chance before you lock it in. This is when it matters who the fiduciary is. This is when it matters who had the final say. And this is when you expose yourself to potential liability. I like to say that when the claim first comes in and the first appeal, that's just practice. When the final appeal comes in, that's when you're getting on the trapeze. Now, either you can work with a safety net or not. For some self-funded plans, they don't need a safety net. They're old hands at this.
Right. They got 30,000 lives. They have their 10 lawyers internally. They've been self-funded before ERISA was enacted in 74.
I'm not scared. But how about those millions and millions of lives who have never had this kind of liability before?
Four million lives.
That is a lot of risk-averse people. And none of them want to take on the fiduciary liability. None of them want to stand in front of an IRO or a court and say, yeah, I denied Susan's claims. Here's why. And I stand behind my decision. And here's all the data I used. And here are the laws that support my decision. They don't want to do it. They don't have the ability to do it.
And it costs a lot of money to do that.
Money, time, resources. Trust me. Nobody whose business is, you know, the purchasing of electronics and the sale to retail distribution centers or the preparation of a delicious dinner or,
sandwich.
Ice cream sandwich. Yeah, that's delicious.
Get hungry, guys.
Come on.
So that's my point. These are people who are experts of what they do, but they are afraid. Even if they're right and they're going to win, they still don't want to go through it. This is where you have the opportunity to say to that employer, you can self-fund, you can save money, you can control your claim, customize data, and at the same time, when a final appeal comes in, refer it to a third party, an expert. The FIA Group is providing this service to its clients, to their plans, to employers. This is your opportunity to say yes on the RFP. We will take over fiduciary responsibility. We are the training wheels for a new self-funder. This is where an employer wants to have some customization of their plan, and at the same time, someone could stand over their shoulder and say, you don't want clam chowder and fettuccine Alfredo in the same meal.
So whereas now, the benefit of being a TPA, we can customize the plan design, and you can have access to your claims data by working with a TPA. The one negative has always been this fiduciary risk piece. There's a risk aversion of the TPA. Now you can match those benefits of being with an ASO or a fully insured carrier where that risk is not with the plan, it's with the third party. You can transfer that risk to us here at the FIA in order to really take advantage of the self-volume funding opportunity. So you can be both customized and protect your own plan.
When we talk about this plan-appointed claim evaluator or pay service, a lot of people you see there, they're asking, well, what type of plan is this for? Isn't this just for RBP or reference-based pricing plans, plans that use Medicare or cost or wholesale or MSRP as a basis, and they don't use networks? The answer to that question is no. I understand where the confusion comes from. There are vendors all over the place that they claim that they're the fiduciary, but you have to understand when they say that they're the fiduciary, what they mean is they're accepting responsibility for their directives. When they reprice a claim, when they tell you what to do, when someone appeals their decision, they're going to take responsibility for those decisions. Well, yeah, I hope anybody would do that. If somebody tells you to do something, you would hope that they would defend that decision and not leave you hanging. What we are suggesting is it doesn't matter who made that initial claims decision. It could be you, it could be the plan, it could be a vendor, it could be your grandmother. I don't care. If it's appealed the first time, who's handling that first appeal? Again, I don't care. But when that final appeal comes in, that last chance to review before it goes to an external, that's when we're going to check your work and make sure it was done properly.
So this product, what we've noticed, we've sold it to almost 100 TPAs so far. What this product has done for us is we realize it is a way for TPAs to pick up new markets. TPAs can pick up new clients by having the service. One, it's a new profit center. TPAs don't have to worry. We have spent, the reason we came up with this service is we've spent thousands of hours a year working with TPAs and brokers and plans where everyone's pointing fingers at who's going to make the final decision. We said, listen, we can make this from a pain, instead of this being a pain point for a TPA, you can make this a profit center. This can be a way for administrators to create a new revenue stream. You don't have to handle these claims and issues internally. You can outsource them to us. You can identify new clients that you didn't have before and charge a fee for it. It's what every one of our clients has done, and they have seen an increase in the amount of revenue, and they have seen an increase in the type of clients they can actually pick up. So you can get some of those 4 million lives. And what we do behind the PACE directive is we take the decision, we do the legal analysis, we handle the clinical review, we facilitate the claims going to external IROs. We're responsible for dealing with the stop-loss carrier. The responsibility is on us. This is a new way for you to generate revenue, clientele, lessen, actually eliminate your risk on the claim decisions. And for most employers out there, even the bigger ones, who now they can shift this risk over to a third party, that risk potentially is now transferred over to us, and we've seen many, many of our clients take advantage of this, especially in this new age of self-funding where we're seeing a very different legal atmosphere out there. Ron?
Sure. So there are a lot of opportunities for cost containment that a plan may be hesitant to access because they, at the end of the day, don't want to be holding the bag if someone questions their decision to utilize such a service. By having a third party step in as the fiduciary, that sort of final decision maker, when final appeals come in, one, by having it the final appeal, that actually enables us to keep the fee low because, as you know, there are a lot of appeals that come through that are clerical issues. Someone forgot to press a button. Someone used the wrong number, the wrong code. The network made a mistake when they applied the discount. They applied the wrong discount. Those are the types of appeals and mistakes that are going to be filtered out at the first appeal level. Those never even reach us. And because we're not dealing with that noise, which is easily resolved at the first appeal level, we're only dealing with the real meat appeals, we're able to keep the fee low.
We're getting a lot of questions on this, a lot of emails that ask us what the fee is. It's a PEPM rate. It really comes down to, here's the bottom line. If we are already writing your plan documents, obviously the fee can be lower, because we wrote the language. It's our wording in the language, so we can actually interpret our own terms. If we have access to your claims data already, obviously there can be a lower fee negotiated because we already see your data. We already have your eligibility information. We're not going back and forth with your people. So it really comes down to whether or not you're a client of ours already and what type of interface that we have with your organization. But what I can tell you is the fee is at a reasonable rate because we have yet to see one of our clients not charging higher rate going out to the marketplace regardless of what we're charging. So in the end, at the end of the day, it's going to benefit everybody. And we're also getting a lot of questions in regards to how we handle the IRO referrals. At the end of the day, if we're making the call on the final internal appeal. If the claim is sent to an outside external IRO, we pay the IRO fee. I'm going to repeat that. We actually pay the IRO fee. And if you already don't have the three rotating IROs as you're required to under the ACA, we have already created partnerships with many of them, and we'll make sure that these IROs are being transferred to these organizations randomly as you're required to under Obamacare.
Right along the same line, because we're responsible for the decisions we're making, let's say hypothetically you and the plan have decided to deny the claim, first level, second level. It comes in at the final level appeal. We look at it and we say, hey, guys, we understand where you're coming from, but you're wrong. If this goes to an IRO, they're going to tell you to pay. We need to pay these claims. If our directive is to pay the claim, you pay the claim, it hits spec and exceeds spec, stop loss gets the claim for reimbursement, and they want to deny because they think the claim should not have been paid, once again, we are the ones who are going to spearhead that appeal. So whether it's a denial that we're enforcing before an IRO or a decision to pay, which we are enforcing in the face of a stop loss denial at appeal, regardless, pay or deny, the directive was our directive. We accept responsibility for that directive.
Well, we're getting some questions in relation to what, you know, expiration of stop loss contracts, if the final appeal comes in, if the external appeal overturns the decision. There's a lot of stuff that there's a lot of legal issues here, legal complexities, case by case complexities. If you want to reach out to us directly on a specific case, these are all the things that you won't have to worry about if you transfer this risk over to us. So, for example, if an external IRO reverses the decision that the plan has made, whether it will a stop-loss carrier be held responsible, well, you should be negotiating that within the terms of your stop-loss contract. All this stuff are things that we take care of. We handle the implementation. We approve a plan or not approve a plan. So if we read a plan doc and see that this plan isn't good enough for the base product, we'll tell you, no, we can't approve this plan, and here's why. So you can actually get your plan to be compliant at no cost to you. So, again, there's a lot of different things you can do to contain costs. The first thing is having this fiduciary responsibility transfer to our organization is one thing. And then by working with us, you create a new profit center, your plans are protected, and then we can find new ways of reducing the cost of your plan, whether it's addressing providers. Remember, this can be used on any type of plan, reference-based pricing plans, skinny plans. Folks, regular network plans can have this product. And most of it, 95% of our sales so far, have been on regular PPO network-type plans, not just reference-based pricing. However, if you are doing reference-based pricing and you're doing it internally or you're using a vendor who doesn't have a fiduciary product, this is an easy thing to add on to that reference-based pricing plan doc, because in all probability, we even wrote that plan, since we do a lot of reference-based pricing plans. Also, level-funded plans, skinny plans, et cetera, those type of plans, minimal essential coverage plans that are ripe and made for plans that have been self-funded before, an easy $2 PEPM, $3 PEPM add-on in order to have this particular service. That's really all the time we have, folks. Please join us next webinar on Tuesday, December 15th. We are going to have a very important 90-minute, not 60, 90-minute webinar talking about reference-based pricing and balanced billing. You know why we're doing it? We're sick of the questions.
That's true.
We just can't take it anymore, folks. Honestly, we get so many questions on this, and it's everywhere. Like, we're just going to pray that everyone listens. And if we get a question after this webinar, we're going to literally tell people, go on our podcast.
This is the podcast.
Go on our Podomatic right there, thefeedgroup.podomatic.com, and you can listen to the podcast. It's at minute 37. There's the answer to your question. Literally, that's what we're going to do.
You know,
the number of questions we get on reference-based pricing. If I ask the question again, Ron, it's like a four-day weekend with four kids under the age of three. I can't wait for Monday. Like, it was, thank God it's Monday, TGIF. I'm not even kidding, right? I was dying to come back to work today just so I can make other people do things instead of having to, you know, I don't want to get into that now. But the point I'm trying to make is this webinar is vital. If we get another question asking us, well, the Department of Labor said reference-based pricing is illegal. Listen, There are certain entities in the industry that want brokers and want employers to not do things. So they'll say whatever they have to say to sell their product. Just dial into the webinar. You're going to learn a lot. This webinar, people always ask, where can they get the slides? Go to our podcast. You can get the slides there. You can go on our website, get the slides there. Chris and John have done a great job to make sure all this stuff is available for you. Ron, anything you want to add?
Yeah, I will actually, Adam referenced the fact that we do get a lot of questions about reference-based pricing plans, what's legal, what's not, the FAQs. You know what? For those of you who have actually held on through this conclusionary slide, and
a lot of people there.
Some people have hung up, but some people have stuck on. For those of you who have hung on, what I am going to do, if you would like, you can send a question direct to me at rpeck, P as in Peter, E-C-K, rpeck, at fiagroup.com. Title it RBP question. And what we will do is we will address your question.
We're going to say your name.
Yeah, we're going to use your
question was.
I swear we will. We'll change your name to protect the innocent or not so innocent. But what we will do is we will absolutely address your specific question in our webinar.
Also, if you have an interest in PACE, please email us at pace@fiagroup.com. If you're interested in learning more about our service, talking to Tim Callender or to John or Ron or myself in regards to this unique and very special service that has taken off across the country, please let us know. And on behalf of Chris, John, Ron, and myself, have a great week. We'll see you all on December 15th for RBP. And as Ron has asked, feel free to email him any reference-based pricing questions you have for that webinar. Thank you so much for believing us. Thank you so much for spending an hour with us. We appreciate it. Have a great day.